Welcome to Glide. Welcome to the power of love. I'm Rita Shimon. I'm one of the co-executive directors of the foundation here, the Glide Foundation, with Kristen Yamamoto. And on behalf of all the Glide staff and our senior pastor, Karen Olivito, we welcome you. We welcome you. I also bring a very warm and very special welcome from Reverend Cecil Williams and our founding president, Janice Merritt Catani, our co-founders. Cecil really wanted to be here with us tonight, but he's under the weather a little bit, and so he's taking care of himself, which we like. He's not here, but he wanted me to give you a message, and especially our guests who you will meet soon from Ferguson. The message is, we stand in solidarity with you. Reverend Williams, and I'm sure some of you here in the audience, marched with Martin Luther King, and he wanted us to say, that's how we're standing in solidarity with you. So you're going to have an exciting evening here where you hear the voices from the ground. And we have a distinguished panel that you'll hear from. I'm not going to mention all of their names because they're going to be introduced, but I wanted to say something special about Michelle Alexander, who wrote the next Jim Crow. And we sent, Glide sent, 55 staff members to see her last year. We had a group of 12 staff members who did a book group that read her book and discussed her book, and in preparation to see her. And that work, those conversations, helped us to understand the complexity and the severity of what we are all engaged in here. And this conversation tonight is going to deepen that understanding for all of us. I want to thank the Commonwealth Club for having this important conversation here at Glide. Often their conversations are held downtown, but it's so appropriate to have this conversation here at Glide tonight. For those of you who don't know about Glide, every day we deal with communities who are suffering at the effects of oppression, suffering at the effects of poverty and marginalization. Sometimes we feel like we're a hospital here for healing because people come to us for services who are just getting out of prison and don't have anywhere to go. People come to us for services who are suffering the long-term effects of poverty or disabilities or being marginalized, being pushed out of their homes or just running away from their homes because they can't live there. So we know what that is. We have so many services here, I'm not going to list them. I want you to go to the website and see what we do here, from a sixth-floor healthcare, primary healthcare clinic, to serving 75 kids after school every day, and everything in between. 364 days a year, we serve 3 meals a day. We do much more than that. Thank you. We like to hear it. So lastly, I just want to ask a favor from you all. You know, so often in these heated kinds of conversations, we're going to hear the authentic voices of youth from the ground in Ferguson and the surrounding area. And so often we listen to each other from the place of right and wrong. And we think we're listening to positions that people take rather than listening to the human being who is speaking to you and who has a history. So I just invite you to listen tonight to each of you, each other, listen to yourself if you speak, as a human being who has a story. And let's see where that takes us tonight when we hold each other in our humanity. We love you. We love that you're here, and please enjoy your evening. I'm going to turn it over now to Mr. Fisher from the Commonwealth Club. Thank
Thank you, Rita. You and I are about the same height, right? So is it okay if I pick this up? Good evening, everyone. Welcome. My name is Mike Fisher. I'm the Director of Membership at the Commonwealth Club. All of us at the Commonwealth Club are so pleased to be involved at this event, and I want to extend a special thank you to GLIDE for hosting this and enabling it to be bigger than it otherwise could have been. The Commonwealth Club is the nation's leading public affairs forum. We're the oldest, largest, and most prolific. We are a member-supported, nonprofit, nonpartisan organization, and you can find more information about us at the back of the sanctuary. The program will begin in just a few minutes with Sajari, a young poet from right here in San Francisco. The program will be about an hour long, and then we'll bring all the speakers back on stage for live questions from the audience. Now, if you all please take out your phones and any other devices that can make noise, make sure that you're switched to silent. And in closing, I'll say this room is a remarkable place to connect with those around you, especially to greet someone new to you. So I encourage you to take the next few minutes and greet each other as we wait for Sajari to come out and begin the program. Thank you all for being here.
This poem is entitled See Black Boy Run. It's written and modeled after Roger Reeves' Cross Country. Some of the language in this poem is not meant to cause controversy or conflict, but more so to incite conversation. I wrote this poem, and I was inspired to write this poem because of the recent events in Ferguson and all of the young black men and women who've been killed and shot unarmed. So this is in their spirit. See black boy run, shot one. When he ran, it rained niggers. The first shot, splitting him like an open sky, his body a gutted cloud, his blood splattered fresh against a field of asphalt that knows well the salt of sweat and death. When the first bullet hit, the flail of black boys running in unison with limbs that mimic black birds spreading wing to cut the wind. I'm sure the officer mistook them for crows, mistook them for scare, for anything other than human, swore that he wouldn't let them all get away. Bystanders watched as the officer took aim, how he made target practice of the spirit in the boy's sprint. Shot two, three, four, five, and six. The swell of his flesh rose like the hem of Lazarus buried in a mother's throat. A cry for resurrection as each shot conjured the ghost of boy after boy whose name has gone silent in the street. The bullet nestling in his flesh as he ran for some semblance of a safety he knew he'd never reach with his feet. Only death awaits black boys who dare to run. His breath burning in his chest chased an afternoon sun, left him choking, trying to swallow the sun. Shot seven. With his skin melded to hot metal, the metal melting the noon into dark bayou, poplar tree into a rope with 13 tied knots at his back swinging, he turned to face the extended arm of the law unhooded, his hands up, a plea of okay. Okay, I'm unarmed, don't shoot, met with four shots that rang in the air like nigger, hot off the tongue of Emmett Till's killers, like the panic in the voice of a Zimmerman just before the scuffle and scatter of Skittles, nigger, like the shotgun answer of a man to a panic black girl's knock at his door, just like nigger, the sandwich mistaken for gun, the gun in the hands of an officer legally sanctioned to kill at question a whole 17 shots after shot eight. And shot nine, grazed his raised arm, his dropped palms cradled close to his staggering body, an attempt to hold back the ghost spilling between his hands, standing the ground a red lacquer, black death in high gloss. Shot 10, pierced the eye as to stymie the sight well into the afterlife. Shot 11, dispensed in the boy's head, the officer's clip near emptied the boy's body, left to empty 4 hours in the street. See black boy run. When he ran, it rained niggers. His body made vessel the troubled waters of his flesh, a broken levee. The others with skin of sepia, mahogany, chestnut, and ebony watched him flood beneath a seething sea of his own blood. The blood, a collective memory a reflection of the gutted glory that is the black body, the black body. A splitting sky spitting a bundle of crow feathers scattered against the wind to paint the streets crimson, the black body. An omen of sacrifice amid a system of sacrilege which deems this body unholy, is unworthy of justice, even gunned down in its own blood, even in its innocence.
Here, one more round of applause for Sajari. That was Sajari Bradley. Genius. Well, first of all, I just want to say that this is not going to be as advertised. This was advertised as the Commonwealth Club. This is going to be the Uncommon Wealth Club tonight. This is going to be uncommon. Because we're going to actually hear from people who have been on the ground in Ferguson. Most of you are here because you realize that as much as you try to figure it out on Twitter, as much as you try to figure it out on Facebook, as much as you try to figure it out watching the mainstream media, there is some truth that is profound that we do not have access through these screens, and through the mediated media. Tonight, we're going to get the truth. Tonight, we're getting the truth. Directly from the people who are experiencing it. Part of the reason that we have the opportunity to get the truth is because tonight we have an uncommon leader in the form of Pastor Mike McBride. Give a round of applause to this brother right here. He gets mad at me because I praise him on CNN all the time, but this is a true brother. He has a church here in the Bay Area, but he has humbly walked with the folks on the ground in Ferguson. So we're going to give him the opportunity to say what this is all about tonight, and then we're going to turn it over to him for a little while. But give Mike McBride a round of applause.
All right. So certainly, I am blessed to have all of you here. When we first conceived of this idea, me and some of the folks at the Commonwealth Club were thinking, could we get 200 people like in 2 weeks to fill up the Commonwealth Club? And when they told me that everybody in town was coming, it's a testament to the folks that we're bringing. I born and raised here over in the Bayview, and certainly pastor church. I lead a national campaign with the PICO Network around gun violence and mass incarceration. So in the course of our work, we have made many, many relationships all across the country with a number of clergy. I found out about Mike Brown being killed on Facebook, and a couple of clergy called us on Tuesday and said they needed our help. Two sisters, by the way, Pastor Tracy Blackman, Dr. Cassandra Gould, who are still very much involved, called us, kind of like Mary and Martha, who went to the tomb to see Jesus. Somebody say amen on the first night. It wasn't the brothers that was there. I wish I had a church, right? But anyway, what was most profound to me when I got there was that I saw young people outside. I saw elderly people outside. I saw folks in wheelchairs, and they were being brutalized by the police. And they were crying out for help, and nobody was helping. We have some relationships through our work with a number of folks at the federal level. And after a number of our team got tear gassed, I said, surely, if we call the White House, if we call the Attorney General, if we call all our homies, they would answer. Nobody helped. And it became a moment for me where I think I realized that what's the point of being progressive if you're not going to help people when they need you at their deepest moment. So I've been connected with these young folk ever since we kind of met in the crucible of being tear gassed, shot at with rubber bullets, being called, I'm glad, Sister Sojari, nigger, and animals, having guns rammed in the back of our backs, told us English must not be our first language, had tanks, had flashbang grenades, all of this in a small, like less than 1 mile radius area, I began to realize that whatever we're doing, we're not doing enough. So part of what I'm hoping that we accomplish tonight is that we all take a look in the mirror and really ask ourselves, what are we willing to do? To not only address the Ferguson with the big F, but the Fergusons that are right here in San Francisco and Oakland and Chicago, New York, New Orleans, realizing that all over the country, people are being brutalized, and it's happening on the watch of Democrat presidents, attorney generals, governors, mayors, people. We got to do more, and that's what I hope we accomplish tonight, and I think all of us being here is going to help us to do that.
Very good. Give him another round of applause. So we're going to transition to get some actual voices up here, just to add to the overall thing. Y'all may think that this is just for us in this room, and I wish the people on the radio could see how diverse this room is and how big this room is and how crowded this room is and how hot this room is. But literally, for every person in this room, it's about 300 people, there are 300 radio stations. They're going to be broadcasting what's said here tonight. And so for the first time, the whole country can hear the true voices of some of the folks who are here. And the people who are here, as you will see, for them it's not a partisan issue. It's not an issue of one political party versus another. It's not an issue of all cops being bad or all cops being good. It's an issue of humanity. With that, I'm going to turn the stage over to and welcome to the stage both Tori Russell and Tef Poe. Come on up here and talk to Brother Mike.
So, guys, we met on the ground in this Ferguson, St. Louis County. Both of you guys, within hours, were connected to what was happening on the ground. A lot of people may not know a whole lot about the context of what Ferguson and St. Louis is, but maybe can you just give us a quick sense of what is the context, the background? Why do you think the history of Ferguson and St. Louis caused such a reaction at the death of Mike Brown?
I think concretely, it's the same place where Dred Scott had to figure out, or the country had to figure out, was he a citizen? Was he property? Did he have rights? And could the system uphold him? And I think we 150 years past that, and we still don't have that answer. I think a lot of people say Ferguson and St. Louis. I stay 8 minutes from Ferguson. I drive that way every day to drop my son off at daycare. It's that close, and you might have a Ferguson right up the street. You know, I didn't mind being called an outside agitator because I wanted to follow in Martin Luther King and Harriet Tubman's footsteps as being great outside agitators.
Right. Brother Tef, you got there on the ground real quick. Tell us all the kinds of things that really led and fed the kind of outrage from the community. They left Brother Mike's body out there. Tell us the kind of things that you saw with your own eyes, the response from the police, and the way people were really kind of being, in many ways, agitated by what had just happened.
When I got to the scene, I saw every police jurisdiction in the city of St. Louis in that area. And it's not that big of an area. On TV, it looks like a massive area, but it's really only a few blocks. And, I mean, I had never seen anything like it. It was like pulling into the set of a Die Hard movie. I mean, it was cop cars pulled off, blocking traffic. We couldn't enter the community in a normal route. You had to know the back routes to get in. When I got there, people were crowded around the area where Mike Brown had just been murdered, and they didn't know what to do. They were yelling, crying. I saw his blood in the middle of the street with my own eyes. I saw a puddle of his blood, And, you know, I think about that every day. That's the very moment that dictated what I would do after that.
And you're from St. Louis. You've engaged in a number of different campaigns and organizing. You're actually a very popular hip-hop performer, rapper, won awards, all kind of stuff. I've seen them hanging on the wall of your house, right? So you kind of got a little bit to lose. What is making you so engaged and involved in the people in Ferguson? Why do you think people just won't, as some folks say, go back in the house?
Because it's time. It's year after year of oppression, and you get put into a corner, you know, and eventually you just snap and you fight back, and you don't know how you're going to fight back, but you know that you have to fight back, or it's the end of the world as you know it. And I think for the young people in St. Louis, we're delivering a message to the world that says no more normal. We feel the same way they feel in Hong Kong. We feel the same way that they feel in Gaza. And we're saying what you formerly knew as normal has to go.
Now, there's a myth out there that would say that y'all not organized. There's a myth out there that would say y'all are violent and out of control and going into battles with the police. Why don't you set some of the record straight on some of those myths? Because I've seen y'all in action, and I wish I could be so organized. Talk to us a little bit about the myths, about, you know, what you all are actually pulling off in the level of coordination and planning that's going into what's happening.
The Weekend of Resistance just passed. That was young folk who weren't organized 70 days ago, got organized, and we just wrecked it. You know, we did the football game, Plaza Frontenac with the millennials. We hit up Walmart's for John Crawford. It was organized, and it didn't take hundreds of people.
Was it violent?
I wouldn't be here. I don't have no gun. I don't own no gun. All we got is our voices, and we chant. And you would think that guns would come out of my mouth, like that was my superpower or something.
Right.
we haven't gotten into any confrontations. The police, they bring the violence, and we still nonviolent.
70 days, no incidents that we've all aware of up here of police being injured. Talk to us a little bit about why nonviolence. What has been y'all's commitment? Tell us a little bit about these myths and how are we supposed to counteract that?
I mean, in America, anything that's black and angry is automatically labeled violent. So that's the myth. It isn't a kumbaya fest. We're angry. You're gonna see me yell. I have no problem confronting the police when they kill a young brother in my neighborhood and sit there flamboyantly and laugh in our faces. I'm here to say you're going to answer to that. And if I got to take a bullet for that, so be it. But you know what? You can't kill us all. And if you do, so be it. We're going to die trying. So that's how I feel about it.
Part of what I've been realizing on the ground is, you know, there's this sense that you all are certainly upset, but there are also folks who are saying, well, what else? Do y'all have demands? Tell people a little bit about the kind of demands that you all have. Certainly when I arrived in town, the demands were just being pulled together. And less than a week after Mike Brown was killed, you all had 12 demands. Give us a sense of what those demands are and where could people in the audience and listening, where could they find those demands?
Well, first of all, the demands have been up since, I believe, August 17th. On handsupunited.org. They're still there. We got 7 local demands and about 4 national demands. But I think now moving forward, we're going to systematic demands. Just walking in, seeing the homelessness, it really shocked me to see that many homeless people. And I get to walk in and drink some good water. And at the same time, when I go home, they got money for, like, tanks and all this military-grade stuff, and it's homeless people right outside. It's got to be something in the system to correct itself, but it's no checks and balances. So I'm here, and we here, we're going to be the checks and balances from here on out.
Demands. What are some of the demands, particularly in Ferguson? People say, what would you want to happen? What would those demands kind of sound like?
I mean, if you ask the average person, they're going to say justice for Mike Brown in Ferguson. And then people rebuttal that with, well, what does justice for Mike Brown look like? Does it look like the indictment of Darren Wilson? Does it look like the dismantling of the Ferguson Police Department? Like, what does it actually look like? Because when you get those two things, the injustices still stand. The system that produces the injustice still stands. So for me, my only demand is freedom and liberation for all oppressed people. I don't care if you're black, white, straight, gay, purple, pink, whatever, male, female, liberation for anybody that's oppressed. That's my personal demand.
So moving forward, you all are both very much some of the leaders that are helping to continue to galvanize folk. What would you want these folks to know, right? What would you want folks listening to know about yourselves, about the community of Ferguson, about the movement that you all are helping to provide leadership for? What would you want them to know if you could tell them a couple things?
I want you to know that on August 9th, I seen a dead body on my timeline. And probably like you, when tragedy strikes, I scroll right past it. And I kept watching TV, and I acted like nothing was going on. But then something, I had to get over that fear, because that's what it was. I tried to call the newspaper and other people to do the job that you're supposed to do. I want you not to be afraid to go outside with your emotions. Let your emotion move you. We don't have to wait for some organization to come. Just get on up, go outside, see what's going on, and figure out from there. Because that's what I did. I'd say the same thing over and over again. 70 days from now, within these 70 days, somebody going to die. The police might kill them. What, you can't just sit there no more. We can't just sit by idle. We have to get up, and I got up, and I want you to please, I'm begging you, please get up with me.
It's rough, man. I mean, a lot of us have cried countless times about this. If I have to be really honest with you, Missouri has a deeply rooted racism. It's not like, you know, the West Coast or the East Coast. It's not even like the South, because it's the Midwest and people skipped over it when they were doing all of the progressive things they were doing in the 60s. You know, Martin Luther King came there and got booed. They didn't even let him speak. And this was black people. So that tells you what we're dealing with. We a lot of what we're combating isn't even racist white people. It's black people that are still attached to the Willie Lynch doctrine, and they don't even know that we're fighting for them. You know what I'm saying? And in the heat of the moment, I got to stress this, because this is something that I'm really big on right now, connectivity between people. Okay, like the biggest tool that the state has against us is keeping us disconnected, right? So, and that comes in all forms, shapes, and sizes, because there's people who won't talk to the teenager that got the tattoo in his, under his eye. But when they brought that tank and the armored truck 5 minutes from my mama house, that was the same person protecting my mother's property. You understand what I'm saying? So we have to get over these personal prejudices amongst each other. It's no way humanly possible that you could think any type of revolution or any type of liberation is even feasible when you won't even have a conversation with a brother that you threw prejudice at because the news told you to do that. It's just not possible. And I have to stress that for poor people especially, because we all we got. We all we got.
Tori Russell, Tef Poe. Come on, y'all, let's show them some love.
Please give another round of applause for those young men. Somebody said, this is not your mama's civil rights movement. And I think you can see that there's a level of passion, also a level of pain that we need to really listen to and attend to. We also are very fortunate to have here two of the greatest living civil rights leaders who are focused on this issue, not just when it's in the headlines, not just when it's popular, not just when CNN wants to talk about it, but every single day. Please give a warm round of applause to civil rights attorney John Burris and to Michelle Alexander, the author of The New Jim Crow. So Michelle, I'm going to start with you. I have to ask the tough questions of you. There are people who are listening on the radio right now, and they're saying, look, this is a big overreaction. Most police are good. Something bad may have happened. Something bad may not have happened. I just don't get it, why people would jump to the conclusion that there's something wrong with the system. Maybe this police officer did something wrong. But the system works. We have a process we're going through. These allegations that there's something racist about America's system just seem overblown. What would you say to those people if you were trying to get them to listen differently to what they're going to hear tonight?
I'd say you haven't been paying attention. You know, I really want to begin first by pointing out that we're all gathered here tonight not so much because Michael Brown was shot dead and shot down, but because the people of Ferguson stood up and because young people decided that they had enough and took to the streets and stayed there day after day after day and organized a movement out of nothing. And I think it's critical that we recognize that because police killings of black men is nothing new. It has been happening for a long, long time in this country. And the roots of police violence, of course, can be traced back to the days of slavery. And I brought along with me a short quote from an article that Isabel Wilkerson, who is the author of a wonderful book called The Warmth of Other Suns. It's a book about black folks trying to flee the old Jim Crow, hoping for a better life in the North. And she recently published an excellent essay in The Guardian, pointing out the parallels between police violence today and lynchings of an era supposedly long gone. She writes, quote, "Not terribly long ago, in a country that many people misremember, if they knew it at all, a black person was killed in public every 4 days for often the most mundane of infractions, for taking a hog, making boastful remarks, for stealing 75 cents. For the most banal of missteps, the penalty could be an hours-long spectacle of torture and lynching. No trial, no jury, no judge, no appeal. Now, well into a new century, as a family in Ferguson, Missouri, buries yet another American teenager killed at the hands of authorities, the rate of police killings of black Americans is nearly the same as the rate of police of lynchings in the early decades of the 20th century. Let me repeat that. Today, in the era of Obama, the rate of police killings of black Americans is nearly the same as the rate of lynchings in the Jim Crow era. About twice a week, or every 3 or 4 days, an African-American man has been killed by a white police officer. This figure excludes, of course, Trayvon Martin, who was killed by a self-appointed neighborhood watchman, and Jordan Davis, who was killed by a white man for playing his music too loud. Those types of killings aren't included in the statistic because those young men weren't killed by the police. They were killed by vigilantes. Now, Isabel Wilkerson acknowledges that there are many differences between the violence of today and the violence of the past, but we ignore the parallels at our own peril.
She puts it plainly, quote, last century's beast and savage has become this century's gangbanger and thug, embedding a pre-written script for subconscious bias that primes many to accept what they were programmed to believe about Black Americans, whether they are aware of it or not. The killing of Michael Brown is symbolic and reflective of a much larger system of racial and social control in America, just as the lynchings of the Jim Crow era were not some isolated problem to be solved, but reflective of a much larger attitude about whose life matters and whose life doesn't.
Good. If you want to respond to that, I'll let you. But you also are somebody who has sued police departments. You've testified in cases. You're somebody who knows your way around these issues. What strikes you about this particular case? What do you expect out of this particular case? And why do you think it struck such a chord?
Well, first off, I think the
case struck a major chord
because of the sense of hopelessness and frustration that that community was feeling toward the police, in that they were being stopped, detained, arrested, put in a criminal justice system with no real sense of fairness about it. And this case was sort of a symbolic an explosion that took place in the community. And to be truthful, there's an implicit bias, racial bias that exists within the criminal justice system. And so for those in Ferguson and elsewhere, I mean,
how can you say that?
I mean, you say that as if it's self-evident. I say when you look at the enforcement of the drug laws in this state, in this country, when blacks, Hispanics, and whites use marijuana at the same rate, I think it's been proven through all the data that's out there, but blacks are 6 times more likely to be arrested for those offenses. And the implication of that is that they're again placed in the criminal justice system with all of the negative ramifications that go with that. Essentially means, going back to what Michelle has wrote, the new Jim Crow, that people have these badges of slavery that they cannot, in fact, overcome. That is at the root of the frustration that people exist not only in Ferguson but in other cities around. Now, when I look at the case itself, having analyzed a lot of these cases, I just say to all of you, do not buy into what the officer said happened at the car. Assume that it happened. That does not justify shooting someone who is running away, who stops and puts his hands up. And so real questions have been raised about what the grand jury is going to do, what the Ferguson Police District Attorney is going to do. I would only say this, that if the district attorney wanted an indictment, he could have gotten an indictment. If he wanted to try this case, he could have done all of that. But yet, we have all these political ramifications that have taken place that frankly undermine this process. And so if you live in Ferguson or you live in Oakland and you see that process, you have to question whether or not it's a legitimate process that is designed to get at the truth. Now, we had our own case here in Oscar Grant. We saw what happened there. The case ultimately was tried in another place. But what Michelle has said, this case is symbolic and representative of what goes on throughout the United States. Well, since then, we have had 3 police shooting of unarmed men in the Bay Area since Ferguson. And only one of those has received any kind of public attention. So I want us to be mindful.
Let me push back on some of this stuff. That all sounds great. But what do you say to the person who says, what about the killings that are happening where young black men are killing young black men? Help me understand. If I'm listening to you, John Burris, I'm listening to you, Michelle Alexander, why are you so exercised about these kinds of killings? And yet we are not having the conversation, at least tonight, about the other killings.
Well, we're not having it tonight, but we should be having it. I mean, there's no doubt that we should all be upset about what is happening to young African-American men, blacks killing blacks. We obviously should be upset about that.
And in your mind, should that trump our concern about the police?
Absolutely not. One is the state, and one is the government, and its impact on our lives is far more reaching than anything else because it determines how we are going to be treated, the kind of benefits we're going to get or not thereof, and whether or not a police officer is going to be held accountable in the same way that anyone else is when they, in fact, take a person's life unjustifiably so.
You know, absolutely. And, you know, I think it's reasonable for us to hold police officers to a higher standard than a gang member who is, you know, finding it difficult to control his rage after something that has happened to his crew. We should hold law enforcement to a higher standard. But beyond that, I think what so many people fail to grasp is that it is the same punitive mindset and the casual disregard for the well-being and lives of poor people of color that's manifested by Michael Brown's killing, which is the reason why we have jobless, segregated communities with high crime rates. It is the same mentality that has allowed us to quintuple our nation's prison population in a 30-year period of time while divesting from education, pulling out of inner city, you know, communities, moving jobs overseas, leaving islands of poverty surrounded by great wealth and opportunity. It's the same mentality that says those people, those lives don't matter, can be left behind, locked up, and thrown away. It's that same mentality that allows a police officer to say, what the hell, I'm going to pull the trigger.
You know, one point on this, I got to follow. As a follow-up to that, one thing that's most disturbing is the demonization of a black person's life. If you remember in the Michael Brown case, even though the cop had nothing to knew anything about it, Michael Brown was then being depicted in a most negative light about this robbery that may or may not have occurred. But I'm going to tell you, in your everyday lives in every community, when a young black person is killed by the cop does not know that person's record. But the media immediately gives that record because the police does that. And that's because they do not want you to care about this black life. They do not want you to have any empathy for that person. And at the end of the day, it allows for the cover-up to take place. Because
speaking of cover-up, a lot of people here and who are listening are trying to follow this process. You are probably the most renowned litigator of these issues in the country at this stage. So I want to ask you, I want to ask you a couple of questions because I've been begging. Just yes or no. Is it normal for, in a high-profile situation like this, for a local district attorney to punt to a grand jury and give them no instructions? Is that normal?
No, it is not normal. Normally, cases these days go before a preliminary hearing. If you go before the grand jury, other than the federal system, which is all grand jury, the state system really isn't. And generally, if you go before the grand jury, the prosecution is basically telling the grand jury what they want to occur. They put on the evidence that they need to put on, which is only probable cause. I have never, ever heard of a defendant, the subject of a grand jury, to testify. That is unheard of.
Now, I just want to make sure that people here and people at home hear what you just said. It is highly unusual for a local prosecutor to punt to a grand jury. It's highly unusual for that grand jury to be not given, for get no instructions. And it's almost unheard of for someone who might be facing a murder charge to go and sit down and have a casual conversation for 4 hours with the grand jury, unless what? Why might that happen?
Because they want to build in a defense to the grand jury so the grand jury can then decide, well, maybe there isn't proof beyond a reasonable doubt to bring the charges against this person. And that's why I said the analysis has to be greater than looking at what happened at the car.
If the local prosecutor is throwing the case, is it true that the federal government really can't do anything?
That's absolutely not true. And the difference is this. The federal prosecution really is about civil rights. Now, actually, that isn't fundamentally different than killing someone in the first degree. If you kill someone and you're a police officer, you in fact have violated that person's civil rights if you intended to kill him.
Does race matter?
Race does not matter in the civil rights case. Race is not a component. It's merely that it's a law enforcement officer who has killed someone who has denied them of the privileges and immunities that its citizens have, which is the right to be free from excessive force and unreasonable use of force.
So you're saying that Obama's Department of Justice could do something?
They absolutely can.
Okay.
Now, I haven't seen them do cases and in individual cases often, but they can.
Let me ask Michelle. We're almost at time. Michelle, the local prosecutor doesn't seem to be taking it seriously. Certainly, the Obama administration has at least made some noises. As your last comment and observation here, there's a Democratic governor, Governor Nixon, who could appoint a special prosecutor tomorrow morning. What do you think a civil rights movement approach would dictate that we do when you have a sitting Democratic governor who seems to be disinterested in this kind of injustice?
We need to organize. We need to put a tremendous amount of pressure on all levels of the political system to acknowledge the dignity and humanity of Michael Brown and all those who have faced this kind of lethal and justified action by the police. And, you know, as John Burris has so eloquently just described, it's not that holding them to justice is unfeasible. There's a lack of political will to do it. And the only way in which that political will materialize is if we make it necessary, if we organize so that they have no choice but to do the right thing. And we've seen time and time again throughout our nation's racial history that it is only when poor people, people of color, and their allies find their voice, organize, and develop the political strength so that they can no longer be ignored, that real change ever comes.
Thank you very much.
It's called voting. Voting.
All right. Thank you very much. All right. Give a round of applause to John Burris and Michelle Alexander. They're going to stick around for the questions and answers. Two of our great leaders. Next, we're going to hear from the voice of a young man named Marcellus Buckley, who's going to add to the poetry in the room. Give a big round of applause to Marcellus, one of our great young poets.
My name is Marcellus. I'm also known as the Ferguson Poet. I'm going to follow my heart. I was going to do a poem for the Michael Brown, but I want us to do a poem for our kids, because this is not your mother's civil rights movement. We do this for our kids, because after us, they're coming up, and we don't want them to face what we're facing. So I'm going to ask you guys a question. The poem is called Safe. I'm going to ask you, why aren't our kids safe? And simply, I want you guys to answer with the word safe. So I'm going to raise my hand up for you guys. Safe. Why on our kids in this place that we call our home? Just know that things can and do go wrong. Oh, please don't mistake. Even those who get rides home from mom or dad on the bus, lives are at stake. And I hope you take the best route that day. Oh, I hope there's no terrorist explosion or bus takeover. Oh, I pray that no one falls asleep behind the wheel, running kids over, taking lives at will, only if they were sober. And I hate to say I hate, but I hate how this feels. So why aren't our kids safe? To my little brothers and sisters walking home every day, it's a struggle having strangers bug you, and I know you feel some type of way. Gangster thugs with no jobs but got their pants off their waist. Only trained to rob, so they got guns to your face. Oh, I hate to say I hate, but I hate how this feels. So why aren't our kids to my little sisters beginning to become young women through the ages 9, 11, end up sinning, end up pregnant, thinking she found love in the beginning, but end up hating herself in the ending, all because of some lustful peeping Tom. Oh, I wish I could rewind and freeze time just to change all the minds of these molester, rape, or hurt or murder child quick while after feeling no guilt. Oh, I wouldn't give these pieces of dirt the day of time to feed poison to my beautiful flower in the sunrise. And until my sunset, I'll protect mine. And I know you feel the same. That's why I say I love you all, but this place, not at all. You ask me why, and I'll simply reply, because our kids are not
safe.
Thank you.
Come on up. Next, we're going to hear the voices of some of the young women, Brittany and Alexis. Let me get your last name correct. I'm sorry. Brittany, give it up for Brittany Farrell and Alexis Templeton right here. Yeah. Now,
can I interrupt right quick?
Yeah, hold on a second. Now, before they have their individual voices heard, they want to do something that apparently is a part of the movement. So I'm gonna let them have the floor.
We just want to make it feel like home. So I'm gonna say, "Show me what democracy looks like," and you're gonna respond with, "This is what democracy looks like." So here we go. I said, show me what democracy looks like.
This is what democracy looks like.
Show me what democracy looks like.
This is what democracy looks like.
I said, show me what democracy looks like.
This is what democracy looks like.
Shut it down.
Shut it down.
They added, if we don't get it, shut it down. I believe that was, but it sounded better when they said it. All right, look. I like the chant. I like the energy. But I know it's a lot of pain, too. You're a mother?
I am.
Why are you doing this?
So, to give you some background, I'm a single parent of a beautiful little black girl. I was working really hard my senior year of nursing school, but I dropped out. With me dropping out, I was a breast cancer researcher at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. I lost my job. I do all of this because one day I was driving in the car with my daughter, and she asked me, "Mommy, what if the police shoot and kill me like they did Mike Brown?" That's why I do what I do.
I want to stay with you just for a second. I don't get it. Why don't young black people just get jobs? I mean, seriously, what happens? I mean, you could just stay away from the police and get a job. Why not?
Well, you know what? It's more like... why can't young black people be themselves without uniformed thugs coming into their neighborhoods to harass them? We shouldn't have to work so hard to have people see the humanity in us. I shouldn't have to validate my existence by letting people know that I'm educated. Because at the end of the day, no piece of paper given to me by a predominantly white institution will save my life.
But let me ask you something. That sounds good. That sounds good. But it's not a rhetorical question. Before we came out here, you were really explaining all of the obstacles that happen to somebody as they are trying to follow the pathway that you're on. And there are people listening, they've never heard that those obstacles. You were telling me about how someone is just trying to go about their lives, things happen to them that maybe people listening don't know about. What happens to a young black person who's just trying to go about maybe getting that piece of paper? What's in the way? In Ferguson.
Well, first, you have to, okay, I'm going to use my own story. I'm going to try to connect with you all as a person who's actually lived this experience. So you have a young woman who ends up falling into that statistic of being falls into the teenage pregnancy statistic, right? And you are quickly labeled as being from birth, being a girl, you're labeled as being a black girl in particular. You're not going to be much more than a pregnant teenager, a high school dropout, a welfare queen, right? So you out the womb with these labels. You're working hard. You're working multiple jobs because you know, as a black woman, a black teenager, your chances of being a single parent are much higher than anyone else. So you work hard. You have to provide for your child. You might have to delay school, which means that you delay opportunities. Once you get yourself in a position to where you can further yourself, you're marginalized because not only of your skin color, but also because of your gender. When you make it so far, there are obstacles presented to you that if you don't have the proper support, you can't get over them. The system wasn't built to support people that look like me. We all know this. The system...
Let me ask you a question. So, when you see other people, because you're out there risking your... I mean, you've been arrested, is that true?
Yes.
You've been tear gassed, is that true?
Yes.
You've been held multiple hours and nobody knew where you were, is that true?
They knew because I tweeted it. The revolution will be tweeted. But we do know, and as a mother of a child, and, you know, she loves me to death like I love her, I know what I'm risking when I go outside every night. You know, I know I'm risking my safety, but there's no way that I can look my daughter in her eyes. There's no way that I can look our youth in our eyes and see the pain that we have been experiencing for years, to see that if someone doesn't do something about it, it will continue. You know, somebody has to do this work.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you then. Well, first of all, give her a round of applause. She's been one of the people who is the foremost front line. It's very hard to find a picture of the front lines without her in it. So just give you a sense of her level of commitment. Here's what I want you to help me with. I have a problem. I got a lot of people who don't understand what we just said. They hear the passion, they hear some of the rhetoric, but they don't get it. I need you to help me. Why are you doing this?
On July, I'm going to connect with you as a human as well. I've never told this story, so, well, congratulations. On July 6, 2013, I was in a car with my father, the love of my life, and my uncle. My dad was drunk, and he was speeding, and he crashed the car, and we all flew out of the window, and I was the only one who made it. So for a year, I went through depression. For a year, I tried to kill myself. For a year, I was not living. I was existing. I woke up every morning as a zombie. On August 9th, I looked at my timeline from Phoenix, Arizona, and I saw that a young boy was killed. I came home and I hit the ground, and Michael Brown saved my life. He made it so I did not want to wake up and hang myself or shoot myself or cut myself. Mm-hmm. So thank you, Michael Brown.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you found out this young brother had been killed, and you went out to the streets. What we saw on television was madness. What did you actually discover when you went out there? What is happening with the young people in Ferguson?
First of all, I want to say that the young people are some of the bravest people I've met in my life. And that's just what it is. I saw them take the elders and put them in the back, and they stood up and faced those tear gases like men and women. some of the strongest people in the world. They sent those older people home and said, it's our time, it's our turn, you've done this. Let me put you down and let you have a seat. Let me do this for you.
Well, that's what I saw. If the police come out and they've got the military hardware and they've got the weapons aimed at you and they've got the tear gas and they've got the pepper spray and they've got the bullhorns and they're saying go home, why don't you just go home?
Because Mike Brown means we got to fight back. They say move back, we say fight back. There is no, you know, you have to meet, if they won't respect our existence, then they will be met with resistance every time.
So, you know, you told me a story earlier about seeing this level of kind of force coming against you and why it is. Like, somebody might think that maybe you're just somebody who just likes to get in trouble or you just like the drama or you like the conflict. I know, because I've talked to you, that there's something deeper. There's a deeper pain and there's a deeper concern for your generation. Could you talk to us a little bit before you go about what your generation is going through, such that they'd be willing to face tear gas over a kid that they didn't even know?
Because I can't go down, as a woman, as a young black woman, cannot walk to my mailbox without being stopped by the police and asked why I'm here. I, as a black woman, cannot walk around my neighborhood with my dog and have one of the residents call the police and have them pull up on me and ask me what I'm doing.
Is this after Mike Brown or before?
This is both before and after.
What is happening to young people? And because people don't understand what's going on with you guys. I got to tell you, look, I'm an old dude. Police don't bother me. And a lot of people listening, the police don't bother them. And so what is happening? You're a young person. You said you're minding your own business. What are the things that happen? You and then you. And I want them to have a chance. Go ahead. Explain to America what is happening to your generation.
At this moment in Ferguson?
On a daily basis. Before Mike.
Before
on
Mike
a
Brown?
Daily basis.
Okay. I'm driving down South Florissant and the lights go off. Whoop, whoop. I get pulled over. Mind you, my car's on cruise control because when you're driving in North County at night, you put your car in cruise control so you don't get pulled over as a black person because they will pull you over for going two over. And so my cruise control is on. I turn it off. I pull over. He comes up to my car, doesn't ask for my ID or my registration, and he says, do you know why I pulled you over? I say, no, sir. My grandpa's a police officer. He always taught me to be respectful to the police. Shout out to grandpa. And so I said, no, sir, why? He said, because it looked like you were about to start speeding. All right, so you know, I make these faces. I'm very, you know, verbal with my face. And I look down at my cruise control light because it's on. I got an old car. And I'm like, so it looked like I was about to start speeding, but my cruise control was on. How do you explain that? He's like, well, it just looked like you were about to start speeding. Can I see your license? He saw my license. Didn't even ask for my registration. Said, drive safe, Ms. Tumbleton, and please don't speed. And he let me go home. But why did you pull me over? This is what young people are facing.
You.
Absolutely. Racial profiling. So I'm outside checking my tire pressure because I'm a single mother and I do stuff like that on my own. And St. Louis Metropolitan Police roll up on me. And they say, how long have you been outside? And I'm like, 5 minutes? He said, someone across the street at this Kmart just stole a cell phone. So how long have you been outside? I don't know. I didn't see nothing. So you didn't see anybody? Are you sure? It was a black male. Dreadlocks, white t-shirt, blue jeans. You sure you didn't see him? He just described like almost every guy in St. Louis. You know, and this is the type of profiling that our young people are subjected to on a daily basis. Pedestrian checks, not because saw you.
They give you checks if you're a pedestrian?
Oh, absolutely. It's similar to like the New York stop and frisk, except In St. Louis, they call it a pedestrian check. Like Vandarrick Myers, the young man that was shot and killed on the south side of St. Louis, who is said to have only been armed with a sandwich, but of course it's three different police reports that say something different. But they stop and they check you, not because they just saw you give a suspicious handshake to somebody and they thought you made a drug transaction, but simply because you fit the profile of someone that can't make a decent living outside of selling drugs.
All right. Well, listen, first of all, I wish we had hours. Because as you peel back, just give me a second. Look, y'all gonna have to fix this in post. I'm sorry. This is real people going through real stuff. Give a round of applause and stay here. Stay here. Yeah. Hold on. But you stay. You stay. Yeah, stay. Yeah. No. Yeah. Stay standing. Stay on your feet. Stay on your feet. Stay. And if you're still sitting down, if you're able to stand up, if not, just raise your hands up. We go and fix this in post. This is real. And for the young brothers as well. Nobody should have to go through what you're going through. People say, this shouldn't be happening in America. This shouldn't be happening to young people anywhere in the world. Period. And I want you to know that there are people in this room who care about you. There are people in this room who care about you a lot. You are embarrassing my generation. You are humiliating us. Because we should have never let this happen. We should have never let it get to the point where people in your age have to stand up for the First Amendment. People your age have to stand up for human rights. People your age have to stand up against tanks in our own country. And we thank you and we salute you for what you're doing for us. So.
Got to fight back. We got to fight.
Now look, I told you it was going to be uncommon, and I want to, first of all, can we please give a round of applause to the Commonwealth Club for being willing to even give an opportunity for these voices to be heard? I'm the moderator, and I'm putting them in a terrible position where they're going to have to go back and try to edit certain things out and edit certain things in, and they beg me not to let this happen. And I want to apologize to you, but as you know, I'm a moderator, but I'm not a moderate, and I got to hear from my people. So now, that said, one of the up-and-coming voices for this young generation who helped to lead a big part of the fight for Trayvon Martin in Florida, whose organization, the Dream Defenders, took the fight all the way to the governor's office. You have seen him speaking out for justice on CNN, MSNBC, but most importantly, you've seen him side by side, humbly walking in the streets of Ferguson. I want you to welcome to the stage Phil Agnew, who's going to talk to us about what we can do.
I gotta correct you a little bit. They don't let me on CNN. Don Lemon don't. Okay, so. So my task, thank you all for having me. Thank you all for allowing me to address you all this evening. My task for the evening is to talk for 5 minutes about the moment that we're in right now. And so I want to start it with saying that they thought it was over when Malcolm fell in the Audubon. They thought it was over when Martin fell at the Lorraine Motel. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men and women are endowed with certain unalienable rights, that of which is life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But when a government acts in the destruction of these, it is the duty, nay, it is the right of the people to alter and or abolish it, to establish a new government, laying on its foundation the principles and organizing its powers to that which the people believe will secure its safety and its happiness. The Declaration of Independence, July 4th, 1776. In 1954, in a neighborhood in Queens, New York, there was a woman named Kitty Genovese. As she walked home from her work, a man accosted her and began stabbing her. She cried out for help, and the man ran away, thinking he would surely be caught. No one came, and he returned and began to stab her again. Kitty Genovese screamed for her life. She screamed for her life, and for the second time, that man ran away, thought he would be caught because somebody would come out and help her. He returned to the lobby of her home, stabbed her, and took her life. Now, this is Queens, New York. That's the type of shit that happens every day. So why is this story one that we will remember? When the police report was filed, it was found that 38 people heard her screams and nobody came out. 38 people on her block looked out the window, turned down their TV for a little bit, turned over to their spouse and said, do you think we should help her? And 38 people went back to sleep. And when a police report was filed, one of the witnesses said, I just didn't want to get involved. Well, this story was baffling to people. How could in America a young white lady named Kitty Genovese die in the middle of the street when 38 of her good-meaning neighbors heard her screams for help? How could this happen? Sociologists rushed into the city. They wanted to understand how it was that 38 of her well-meaning neighbors in America, the land of the free, home of the brave, could allow their neighbor to die. And the sociologists came out with a report, and what they called it was a diffusion of responsibility. It's a scientific principle that says that the more people see a tragedy, the less likely they are to help. The more people exponentially that see a tragedy, that turn on the television every single night, that listen to the bull from Don Lemon, that turn on the TV every night and see a tragedy, the less likely that they'll do something about it. The diffusion of responsibility. They got it. Al Sharpton got it. The National Association got it. There's no need for me to call the police or come out for help because they got it. So when we talk about the national moment that we are in, we are in a Kitty Genovese moment where everybody can hear the screams, every day feast on the delicacy of tragedy. Every day, let your thumbs travel up the timeline for protest porn. Travel for a weekend dalliance against the police to Ferguson and not do nothing. And so when we speak to the national moment we're in, the moment calls for each and every one of us when we hear the screams for help, not just in Ferguson, but in Oakland, in East Oakland, in Sacramento, in Richmond, in Newark, in San Francisco, in Chicago, in Flint, Michigan, Plymouth, Michigan, Pontiac, Michigan, in Cleveland, Ohio, Cincinnati, Ohio, Dayton, Ohio, Youngstown, Ohio. It's time to do something about it. What are we going to do? I want to go back to our previous text for our sermon today. That when a government becomes destructive of those ends, It is the duty and the right of the people to alter or abolish it. We've lived through 40 years of alterations. And I wasn't trained as a tailor. It is the duty of the people to alter or abolish it, establish a new government, laying on its foundation the principles and organizing its powers to which will secure the safety and happiness of the people. The system is not broken. It was designed this way. It's working. So don't wait until they kill another man here, they kill another woman here, they kill another transgender person here, and wait while they leave their body like a carcass in the Sahara Desert for 4 hours to wake up. You came here for a talk. You came here to get the real. You came here to hear some stuff you ain't heard on TV or read on your Twitter or seen on your Instagram or on your Vine or whatever you got. The real is, it's happening right here. So if you want to help the people of Miami Gardens, Miami Beach, Miami-Dade, Tampa, Tallahassee, Orlando, Gainesville, you want to help those young people? You want to help those young people? Organize right here. Make it hard for them to sleep right here. Because I'm going to tell you this, we will not go quietly into the night.
Not your mother's civil rights movement. Phil Agnew, give another round of applause to the young brother. I'm going to go right to the radio close. So I got to read out the radio close. Is that good? Tell me what you want me to do. Okay, good. So you and then me. Okay, because this is show business now. We got to make sure that we give the radio stations what they need. So I'm going to do the boring radio close, but we need to hear from Brother Mike McBride to close us out.
I tell our clergy all the time this. When you go back and listen to people who lived during the Civil Rights Movement, everybody says they marched with Dr. King. And I tell them the only benefit you have is Dr. King is dead. And he is not alive to tell us who's lying and who's telling the truth. I keep going back to Ferguson. I keep showing up as much as I can all across the country because I don't want to look my grandchildren in the eyes 50 years from now and have to embellish what I did during the civil rights movement of our time. I pray you will not have to do that as well. You may not be able to travel to Ferguson with a big F. But there's a Ferguson right in Bernal Heights where Alex Nieto was gunned down 7 months ago. All we got to do is find out where it's at and stand next to the people who are crying or weeping. And let's be with the people. And that's what my challenge to all of us tonight would be.
Another round of applause for Mike McBride. There will be an opportunity, by the way, to go back to Ferguson. There are going to be many more. In fact, on February the 1st, there's actually going to be a hackathon where young technologists are going to be working with the young people from Ferguson to start to bring in technology to expose some of these injustices and to create opportunity moving forward. So there's a lot of positive things that are happening that don't get on television. So let's give a round of applause to the creativity of these young people. Now, here's what's going to happen. They got to fix so much stuff in post now I can just talk. So, look, I'm going to read the radio close. What you want me to say?
What's that?
Oh, good. And I will also be back here. Dory, hold on a second. Come on, look, we may as well just do it all. Give me this here. First of all, give a round of applause to Glide for having this here. Because, you know, Glide is no joke. This is not the first time people spoke about justice at Glide, I understand. Wednesday, October 29th, right here on this stage, I will be here with Jim Gilliam from Nation Builder to talk about how we can build a real movement going forward. And I appreciate the opportunity to be here. Thank you for that. Dory, now here's what we're going to do. I'm going to do the radio close. Then we're actually going to bring folks back up here. And if we are good and people are short, we may be able to hear from a few more voices before we go. Is that okay? Okay, good. Now, I was instructed to tell y'all to quit clapping so much because it probably messed up the radio stuff. I forgot to do that, so I apologize again. This is going to be the most uncommon production. I apologize to you. But here's the radio close. All right, look, I want to thank each of our speakers who poured out their hearts and their minds tonight. Let's be appreciative of Sojourney Bradwell, Tori Russell, Tef Poe, Michelle Alexander, John Burris, Marcellus Buckley, Brittany Farrell, Alexis Templeton, Phil Agnew, and Pastor Michael McBride. And I want to thank you, Glide, for hosting us, and also to our audience for listening to tonight's program. Ferguson, the Bay Area and Beyond, a conversation about race and justice. Thank you. All right. So here's what we're going to do. There are five stools, so y'all figure out among yourselves who's going to sit, who's going to stand. But all of you, including you, Michelle, and you, John, everybody who's been on stage, come back up. Arrange yourselves. If you're not sitting, you can stand on the risers behind. Here we go. If you have a question, there is a microphone back there, halfway back. And all these egalitarian people, nobody can figure out how to sit down. I'm gonna go sit down. Somebody, look, you're messing up the whole picture. Look, this is show business. We need some people sitting and some people standing behind you. Yeah, you sit and then stand behind. Oh my God. I love it. Thank you. Oh, look at that. Look, we want photographs. This is some history. You got to stand. Get behind each other. I know y'all trying to be good. Yeah. Yeah, we want, this is history, so.
Ready. All right.
First question.
Yeah. First question is, are you guys from Ferguson going to be here one more day? We'd love to have you out in Pittsburgh. We'll throw a barbecue and do it one more time. Huh? An hour east of here. You gonna be here one more day?
We can figure that out. How okay. about a question?
The question is this. Well, I'm glad you mentioned
say
it.
Say barbecue with you.
No. We're gonna wait.
You got some Polish.
No.
Okay,
wait.
No, this is my disguise. But any event, the question is this.
Hold on one second. Okay, everybody, seriously. Just for the sound quality on this, because it's just for radio, and if you're driving and you hear a bunch of cheering and stuff like that the whole time, it's hard to keep listening. You might change the dial. So if we could just kind of keep the now it's going to be complicated. We can just keep the cheering to a minimum. We can get you a very short, simple question.
It will be.
And we'll have one person answer.
All right. The question is this. Is that young man from the Dream outfit, far left, hit the nail on the head, is for us to collaborate and move forward. And so is thoughts on organizing here. And we'd like for people of like mind when we leave here, hate to leave empty. And so we'd like to see people gather and congregate before we leave. Throw it to him. Organize. First steps in your mind, organizing locally.
I mean, the first step is to have conversations with each other. And that's the first step of what we do. And so we're organizing in Florida, and it's all based around uplifting the leadership of young people in college, and that begins with meeting people where they are, understanding that they won't be where you are at, and hoping that you can build a community around that leader and start to win. You also got to let go of it and let people move and let them make mistakes.
Very good. Now listen, questions only. If there's going to be a speech, then just out of kindness to everybody else, I will ask you to get you the question only. So thank you, sir.
My name is Joey Johnson from the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. I went to Ferguson to stand with y'all 2 days after the Michael Brown was killed, myself and Oscar Grant's uncle, Cephas Johnson, flew to St. Louis to stand with the Ferguson Rebellion. Somebody said it earlier, what was news was not that another young black man had been killed, but that the people had stood up. And I was sad when two weeks later when I left, because those were some of the freest moments in my life. I want y'all to know we still got your back. October 22nd is the National Day of Protest to stop police brutality, repression, and the criminalization of a generation. People can go to stopmassincarceration.net.
Thank
Cornel
you.
West and Carl Dix call for it. Be in the streets of Oakland.
Thank you,
good brother.
In the afternoon.
So, Tori, talk about October 22nd. Talk about October 22nd.
October 22nd, we doing the same thing. We OBS, Organization for Black Struggle, 35-plus years. We going to be out there. We stand in solidarity with 22 other cities. Thank you.
Good. All right. Good. One more. We got to get some women answer some questions, too. So hang on, sisters. Go ahead.
This is a question about a backward society that we happen to live in called the United States. After Trayvon was killed, I was sitting in tears on my computer. I typed into Google how to protect black men. And Google, you know, sometimes makes a suggestion. The suggestion it offered me was how to protect white women from black men. Clearly, somebody was typing that in because that was the suggestion it offered me. This seems like it's not just a legal problem that we have, but it's a problem with people's attitudes, seeing the people like you who are beautiful as human beings. How, and maybe this is a stupid question for me to ask you, maybe I should ask people who look like me, how do we help people who are white see you as full human beings with full rights to be protected and be safe and be fully a part of this supposedly beautiful country? How do we help?
The answer is white privilege, and I want you to take your white privilege and I want you to go into your neighborhoods, into your jobs, to your next door neighbor, to whoever. And I want you to hold this conversation with them and ask questions and to start the conversation, because it starts with acknowledgement. And when there's no acknowledgement, that's when things like this happen, because people don't understand. So you have to make them understand from your perspective with your privilege.
And another thing is, don't be afraid to make people uncomfortable. You have to move people into discomfort in order to move them to think and move them to act. It's not an easy process to get people to wrap their minds around something that they have been conditioned for so long to believe. You know, to get them to think otherwise, it's not easy. You almost have to make them uncomfortable. White people don't like talking about white privilege. They like to act like it doesn't exist, and then they like to turn the question around and say, well, what about black privilege? That's a conversation we had on Twitter today. Black privilege does not exist. It's time for white people to acknowledge the fact that white privilege does exist. Have those conversations. Make people very uncomfortable.
Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Felicia Jones, and I just want to welcome you all to the Bay Area and to share with you just for a few seconds, Van, that I am so proud of you guys, of being change agents. And I just want to say that. But also in me saying that, the question is this, is that even though Ferguson is the hub of the new civil rights movement, how do we begin to make all of these beautiful people here who are representing democracy, that Ferguson is right here in San Francisco. When we look at the disparities of black people, of mass incarceration, of our black kids not being able to go to school and being suspended, when we look at the health, when we look at the housing, the evictions around housing, the unemployment rate, I mean, yes, I support Ferguson. I will be there tomorrow. I will be there on the 22nd, but I am here to relay to the people of the Bay Area that Ferguson is right here. So you need to get involved right here, because if we don't state that Ferguson is in San Francisco, we continue to always see Ferguson as Ferguson, Missouri, not San Francisco, California. Power to the people.
Okay. So
first of all, you have a beautiful last name. Second of all, go ahead. Miss Jones.
So just concretely, November 4th is Election Day, in California, Prop 47, the greatest opportunity we have to roll back decades worth of archaic and punitive drug enforcement policies, and it will send hundreds of millions of dollars back into our communities to follow folks who are coming home for nonviolent drug offenses. It doesn't solve everything, but it's a start. Make sure we turn people out to vote. The second thing I will just quickly say here, find organizations that are actually doing this kind of work. We all, if we live here in the Bay Area, got money. Somebody say amen. Amen. A lot of our organizations doing this work are underfunded, understaffed. We should scale up these organizations, put our money where our mouth is, and then bring our bodies out into these spaces and places and put ourselves on the line and not just talk about it at these kinds of meetings. So get involved, like Phil said. And when there's a shooting in a neighborhood, don't assume the young person is guilty. Show up and just sit there and be there, and you may hear a different story.
Really good. All right. So we are getting short on time. Folks have to be here when we leave to clean up, to do the work. They want to be able to get home and see their families as well. So we only have about 7 more minutes, and we've only heard one female voice. So I'm going to let you go, brother. No, you go. But then I want these sisters to come forward. I'm gonna discriminate against you, dude. I'm sorry. But I want these women to come forward. Step forward. Step forward. So, and what we'll do is, rather than try to respond, what we'll do is you ask yours, she'll ask hers, she'll ask hers, and she'll ask hers. And then we'll respond in our totality to be done, okay? So.
I can just let them go.
What'd you say?
I can just let them go.
Thank you, brother.
Oh, could we have a round of applause for the brother? Oh, my goodness. Go ahead, sister.
Okay. Hi, my name is Tamara. I'm from South San Francisco. I went to HBCU and I moved back a few years ago. That's all I wanted to say. But my question is, and this is something I'm working on now, is for anyone, when did you first realize that you were black? So that's my question.
I realized I was black. I was a kid walking the streets of Southside St. Louis, and there was a guy being beat up by the police. I had to be about 8 years old. He was being beat down by the police. I had never seen anybody be beat like that by anybody ever in life. And I asked my aunt why they were doing him like that, and she said, because he looks like you. And that's when I knew I was black. I knew I was black when I was in the third grade, and I walked into my bedroom, and we had a bed frame, and it had no mattress. And I asked my mom, why we poor? And I had the realization that we're poor and black.
Dr. Burris, can you jump in? When did you realize you were black?
Well, I'm a lot older than everyone else, but I'll tell you, I learned as early as everyone else did. And I suppose it goes back to in the first grade, I went to an all-white school in Vallejo, and the pictures came back that year, and I was the only black dot in the class and school. And it was probably the first time I realized, you know, that I was actually different from everyone else in the class. But that didn't mean as much to me then, just because, you know, I was a young, small kid. But as I began to listen and watch the news, particularly during the Civil Rights era, and could hear what was being said by all the really great people, the big fours they had during that time. Clarence Jones would know the big four. I come to understand the whole differences in racism in 57 when you had the Little Rock Nine. These things, not so much that I was physically, it was just that I became aware that there was a disparity that existed in the world. And so I have always been mindful of those issues. And certainly have fought and been involved, not so much for me, but for everyone else.
Thank you, Ben.
And so I have a very philosophical notion about it, but certainly the Civil Rights Movement had a major impact on me to make me realize where I was, who I was, and what needed to be done.
Amen. All right.
Well done. Thank you, Ben.
I was going to apologize for my generation allowing
it to get this bad where you don't feel safe in your community. My question is, if Missouri was a country, we would probably right now have economic sanctions against them because of the human rights violations. What could the country do to change, since, you know, I just want to support you and to spread that the rest of the country criticizes Missouri?
Well, I mean, just know who the enemy is. Biko asked that question all the time. And it's the system. And I want you to direct your anger into the education part, the economic, the employment, the police, the prisons, all those systems, and attack those systems. Don't attack each other. You know, it's easy for me to hold Phil accountable. It's a system in place for that. We got to create a system to hold that horrible school system accountable. And that starts November 4th.
I just want to say, I want to say one thing real quick. In addition to that, black people, brown people, poor people are an impoverished colony within America. And so the police are an occupying force within that area. And so if we're talking about economic sanctions, we're talking about ending American militarization incursion into our community. So, you know, that's a politic refined right around this area right here. We're an occupied community right now. And so when you're talking about that, you got to talk about black people, brown people, poor people, and the people in this room right here.
All right, so this will be our last question.
Hi, my name is Natalie Ortega, and I'm with Race Forward. So I have two questions. One is for the young women on the stage. I would love to hear your experience of anger. I felt like it's gender to talk about pain. And the second question is from the young men on the stage. I'd love to hear your experiences with the pain that's going on.
My experiences with anger, they usually, I usually display it in my conversations with the police when I'm standing face to face with them. There have been few different nights when I channel that anger by asking them to look me in my eyes and see the humanity in me. There was one night when I called my mother, and I put her on the megaphone, and I told her to ask the police, why don't they value our lives? You know, my anger is channeled in ways to get them to see us as human beings. You know, I could be angry and I could tear stuff up all day long, but that won't reflect what we're trying to do in terms of attacking a person's morale. You know, we need you to see us cry like you cry. We bleed like you bleed. We have emotions like you have emotions. So I channel the anger in a different way. I'm definitely boiling every time I'm out there. But I have to find a different way to do things.
I channel my anger through chants. I put every piece of me into every word that I say every time to make sure that everybody who's reciting after me feels that pain and feels that anger and channels it in a positive way so that they can hear us. And we, like, I let them know through that anger and that chant that you will hear us and you will stop killing us. It will stop through this chant, through whatever we have to do, through every body movement, through everything. So everything comes from my passion in every chant.
Okay. Brothers.
Before this incident, I didn't hate police. Like, I dislike police. But hate is a strong word, so I try to stray from that word. Like, when somebody says they hate something, to me, when you say hate, there's no coming back from that. At this current moment, I hate police. Hate police. And if you went through what we went through, it's impossible not to. So, because let's say they arrest Darren Wilson right now. All right, cool. The same police officers that tear gassed us and maced us are still on the force. And I put my face out there as a person that's resisting this, and I have to deal with the fact that they can now pull me over. When this is all done, I can get pulled over. My brains get blown out 5 years from now. That's that. And more than likely, it can and will happen. If I reside in this neighborhood, they might try to kill me, because they're gonna try to have the last say. And it just pisses me off, because we're all young, and this is what we gotta do, man. Like it's some BS, man. Like I asked myself when this first started, when you're young and you're black, you're gonna go through certain things. You either gonna sell dope, join a gang, go to prison, or through some crazy incident, you become some type of Huey P., Bobby Seale type revolutionary dude and go on a wild journey and discover yourself through that and either die or go to jail. I never thought that I would end up on the latter of those options. Like, I never imagined that. I don't even know what I'm doing. You know what I mean? And people telling us we crazy, yeah. Telling us we lost our minds. Like, they didn't see a young man in the middle of the street for 4.5 hours. And we got to get up and defend that. But we young. And on a certain level, I feel like it's not fair, you know? I don't know.
We got one more sister. Go ahead, sis.
Just to respond to that question, definitely. As an artist, the way that I channel my anger is through my personal agency and my writing. I had to write and speak myself into existence in classrooms where my narrative wasn't represented at all. Our narrative typically, historically, traditionally is not represented in all of us up here. Our personal agency is what leads us to act, given the anger we feel and are exposed to, given the injustices that we're subjected to and have been traditionally, historically subjected to. It's in our bones, it's in our blood. And that's something that I feel like you can't ignore, nor discredit, nor negate. And it's something to pay attention to. And so in terms of the humanizing piece, I think that's a huge thing. We need to be able to be on platforms where we can speak our humanity, where we can definitely address the inhumanity that we face in this country to this day. As young folks fighting and speaking, it's imperative that we always have spaces for our voices to be heard and to be respected and to, for folks to understand where we're coming from.
Well,
hold on, baby. One more, Tori. Tori.
I give you three personal short stories. Low key, for the Lost Voices, I walk out of meetings, and my premise for having any meeting with anybody is I have to tell low key, who's 15, who had a debate with Phil Agnew from the Dream Defenders, and he broke down and cried and said, "You telling me I might die next week?" So I answer to a 15-year-old boy. Then I look at Mike Brown Sr. as a big black dude with a beard, with a son who I want to grow up better than I did. That's two. And three, the reason why I went to the PD, to be completely honest, I heard the mother, Leslie, she said, "Do you know how hard it is to raise a young boy to go to college and graduate high school?" So that's my pain, and I take that everywhere I go, and that's why I come back every day. And I want to thank y'all for coming here.
Okay. So,
come on, y'all. Let's give them a Bay Area love. Come on. It is our duty to fight for our freedom.
It is our duty to win.
We must love and support each other.
We have nothing to lose but our chains.
It is our duty to fight for our freedom.
It is our duty to win.
We must love and support each other. We have nothing to lose but our chains.
We have